Good afternoon. This afternoon's case is Lawrence Williamson versus Walter Joseph Latta and John Sellers as the Attorney General. May I have the entry of appearances, please? First, for the plaintiffs. Yes, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Francisco for the appellant, and moving at counsel table is Jimmy Anderson.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honor, Jason Dunn with Brownstein, Hyatt, Barber, Shrek, on behalf of Morgan Drexen and Walter Latta.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Steve Durr, for Appellees Lawrence Williamson and Donald Drew Moore.
Mr. Dunn and Mr. Durr, are both of you anticipating talking today?
We do.
Okay, I just wanted to warn you that you'll have to divide your own time. You have 30 minutes to divide between you. Mr. Francisco, will you be doing all the chatting?
Yes.
Okay. Then, whenever you're ready, if you have a half an hour, please keep track of your own time if you wish to reserve any for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Michael Francisco, on behalf of the Attorney General and the Administrator. Colorado's legislature, like every other state's, has recognized that the debt settlement industry requires substantial oversight in order to protect consumers. Plaintiffs here, however, would have this court use the relationship of regulation of attorneys to create a loophole that would allow it to avoid these reasonable, generally applicable regulations. This court should decline to so extend the separation of powers doctrine for at least three reasons. First, this court has never applied the separation of powers doctrine to the regulation of non-attorneys. Second, this case follows a fortiori from Crow versus Toll, this court's most recent separation of powers case, where it approved a similar consumer protection statute. And third, to affirm the result below, based on its inverted reading of Rule of Professional Conduct 5.3, would imperil many other general regulations of non-attorneys far beyond the DMSA. First, some background about what the DMSA does to give this some context. This statute was adopted by the General Assembly to regulate providers of debt management services to consumers in Colorado. It does numerous things. It requires licensure, so registration with the administrator, provides various consumer protections to the people that would use those services, including, perhaps more importantly, a restriction on upfront fees, which in this industry were known to harm consumers by requiring them to pay fees before they receive any of the benefit of services, and a vast majority of these consumers often don't finish these programs. And finally, this industry is substantial. The public reports indicate that over the last 5 years, the amount of debt in these programs from Colorado consumers has ranged between $33 million and $120 million per year. And that's just from the 7 registered settlement providers, not including Morgan Drexen. So in that context, the separation of powers arguments become of substantial importance. And looking first at this court's precedents, there's no precedent showing that the separation of powers applies to general regulations of non-attorneys. That's certainly not what Crow versus Toll holds. And if you look at the two other cases, the McKenna case and the Buckles case, this court again found the separation of powers doctrine does not preempt regulations absent unusual circumstances. Looking at the Crow case in particular, there are strong reasons why this court should not affirm the result below, which preempted the Debt Management Services Act. Importantly, in the Crow case, the issue was the regulation of attorneys directly through the CCPA. Here, the primary issue we have is the regulation of non-attorneys, not the regulation of attorneys. And secondly, there was a direct on-point rule in the Rules of Professional Conduct in Crow regarding attorney advertising. And even in the presence of a consumer protection statute that was being applied directly to attorneys, in the face of limited regulation from this court over attorneys, the court found that there was no manifest inconsistency and that these were compatible, and thus it did not strike down that statute. Here we have neither of those facts. It is not being applied with Morgan Drexen directly to attorneys, and there's no direct on-point rule. And thus, there is no manifest inconsistency between this general consumer protection statute and the services being provided.
Counsel, can I just stop you there, just to anticipate an argument that your opposing counsel will make, is that this actually is a regulation of attorneys. That's exactly what we're talking about. Can I get you to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Their argument is indeed that by regulating any non-attorney that an attorney may use for services, you are regulating attorneys. That simply can't be the case. Attorneys, as everybody understands, often hire professionals and service providers, and those individuals who attorneys either employ or contract with are not attorneys themselves. And you can think of it this way. The rules of professional conduct apply to attorneys. They don't apply to non-attorneys. Looking at the heart of their case is looking at Rule 5.3. They've really turned that rule on its head. The rule exists, and by its terms, imposes obligations on attorneys. It holds attorneys responsible for any non-attorney you may hire to do your work as an attorney. It doesn't stand as a general preemption rule that says you can hire anybody who doesn't comply with Colorado law. They look at comment one from Rule 5.3, which simply acknowledges what we don't deny, that attorneys often do hire paralegals and private investigators. But if you read, the very last sentence in that comment is quite instructive. It says that attorneys need to be mindful when they hire these non-attorneys because, quote, they do not have legal training and are not subject to professional discipline. And that is correct. Non-attorneys, Morgan Drexen in this case, is not subject to professional discipline in the rules. So it's not the regulation of attorneys because they admit that Morgan Drexen is itself not attorneys. They're simply contracting with attorneys. Additionally, you can think of other cases where attorneys hire somebody who is a non-attorney to help them. I can think of five examples that are instructive. Private investigators, notaries, accountants, title search companies, and banks. Attorneys frequently use, in many cases, those sorts of individuals to deliver services, just as these people were claiming they use Morgan Drexen to deliver services. All of those are subject to general laws. And what they want this court to hold is that anybody an attorney hires, whether it be Morgan Drexen or whether it be a private investigator, doesn't have to comply with general laws. Colorado licenses private investigators, analogous to the licensure of Morgan Drexen and debt settlement for services providers. And so that's why that argument simply doesn't work. It reaches far too broadly, and there's no way to limit it from the class of non-attorneys who an attorney does hire. And additionally, as I noted earlier, this court has never applied the separation of powers doctrine to non-attorneys. If you think about the separation of powers doctrine from Article 3, it's stated in terms of the powers of the three different branches of government. Undeniably, this court has the power over attorneys. The core of this court's power that has been recognized in these cases is three areas: the admission of attorneys to the bar, attorney discipline, and the revocation of attorney licenses. The power is over attorneys. It's not over non-attorneys. This law is very similar to the consumer protection law that was at issue in Crow. It's a general police power law that may have some overlap, as the words of this court is used, with attorneys' business, but it's not the direct regulation of attorneys, which is what the doctrine serves to protect.
On that point, if I might, if the idea is the Act does not regulate attorneys because that is within the province of this court to regulate the practice of law. What about with respect to the out-of-state attorneys who, if they are practicing under some limited certification or some other alternate not arrangement short of licensing, they're still subject to discipline and subject to rules of civil procedure, rules of professional conduct. How do you explain the separation of powers distinction there?
Well, Your Honor, it's admittedly a closer case when it comes to those out-of-state attorneys. I'd like to note really four things. The first is there really is no standing for anybody, we believe, in this case to make that argument where there is an attorney who's not licensed because everybody understands the licensed attorneys get the exemption, but is merely authorized to practice law. Secondly, as the comments make clear, this regulation applies to, this is a remedial statute, and so the court typically would interpret that to accomplish its purposes, and in this case, protecting consumers. All of that leads up to, this court has recognized that overlapping regulations are acceptable. If you go to the Crow case, what they reject there, I believe clearly, is a rule that dual regulation is unacceptable in the separation of powers. They look at an argument there that says dual regulation under the CCPA and under the rules of professional conduct meant that the CCPA must be preempted. They instead rejected that argument, and they held that there is going to be some overlap between statutes and the professional rules, and in that case, the court goes on to a more detailed preemption analysis on whether or not there is manifest inconsistency or substantial conflict. So even if there were a party properly in the case as an authorized attorney, going through the preemption analysis of toll, we don't believe any of these regulations in the Act create that kind of manifest inconsistency or conflict that should be preempted. In addition, it's the primary purpose of this case is to have the exemption applied to Morgan Drexen, which admittedly is not an attorney, and we believe is subject to regulation as a non-attorney.
Counsel, before you move on, though, could I just get you to directly address, though, your argument that there is no party here, out-of-state party, who can raise those claims. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. Attorney Williamson is the only party who claims to be a merely authorized attorney. We believe there's two problems with his standing. The first is his own affidavit and claims in the case are that he always hires local counsel who is licensed in the state, so we don't believe he has any injury. Secondly, we don't believe he's established that he qualifies under Rule 220 to be a merely authorized attorney, and that's because he, through Morgan Drexen, systematically advertises for Colorado clients in Colorado. And our interpretation of that rule is that that does not qualify for mere authorization. It's important to remember that that status as a limited license through mere authorization is not something that you can go check with the Office of Attorney Regulation. It's, in this case, just Mr. Williamson claiming that he qualifies for that, and we don't believe he does qualify for that exemption.
Thank you. You mentioned the remedial nature of the statute. Can you expound on the significance of that in construing the attorney exemption here?
Yes, Your Honor. The remedial nature of the statute goes to two things. If there's any ambiguity in the attorney exemption, the legal services exemption, which would really only apply to the original version of the Act, not the amended version, which there's no dispute, it should be interpreted to cover the conduct that was intended to be regulated. Put otherwise, and there's cases to support this in the brief, any exemption to a remedial statute should be construed narrowly. And so as to the original version of the Act, before the amendment was passed, which made it abundantly clear that contractors to attorneys are covered, it should be interpreted, the exemption should be interpreted narrowly. So that's how that would benefit this court's task in interpreting the original version of the statute. Turning back to Rule 5.3, the separation of powers arguments that have been made here all turn on a presumption that attorneys have the right to hire any non-attorney assistant they want, notwithstanding any other laws. Put otherwise, their argument that the attorneys need to have a right to hire a third party that is engaging in illegal conduct, because Morgan Drexen is subject to the statute. They don't dispute that under the amendment. They only claim the separation of powers gives them a constitutional exemption from that law. They should be subject to the regulation, just like the registered service providers are. And when they speak about it in the briefs and in the district court's opinion, they use words like, attorneys have a right to freely associate with a non-attorney. There's a freedom to hire anybody as they see fit. It's a broad freedom, and it's an express right to hire somebody. None of those words are reflected in Rule 5.3, nor in Comment 1. Again, it's just the opposite. The rules of professional conduct are imposing an obligation on attorneys that whenever you hire a third party, be it an accountant, a debt services provider, a paralegal, or the like, you are responsible for their conduct, and indeed, through the rest of the rules of professional conduct, it stands to reason that you're responsible to make sure the people you hire comply with Colorado law. And in this case, they are asking for this court to allow them to have the right to hire somebody who does not comply with Colorado's law, the general licensure and regulation of debt settlement services.
So it's your position here that the only separation of powers problem is that if we override this piece of the statute that subjects them to the act, that's where the separation of powers problem would. We'd be extending protection or regulation of attorneys to non-attorneys who, according to this act, are subject to the regulation, right? I mean, that's the separation of powers problem, because the legislature has respected our authority by exempting the licensed attorneys.
That's correct, Your Honor. The General Assembly has made this an easier case than Crow versus Toll, because they have built in an exemption for licensed attorneys in this act, and they've amended it, and it's very clear that the direct regulation of attorneys is not what the General Assembly is trying to do here. They're instead trying to regulate entities like Morgan Drexen that may or may not associate.
And if we tuck them under our mantle, we actually do have a separation of powers problem because of this statute. We're reading out the legislature's regulation of non-attorneys.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, if this court were to adopt rules directly regulating debt settlement providers, there would be a much more clear conflict that would have to be worked through the analysis and Toll on whether or not it's inconsistent. There are cases that this court, such as Toll, has found that there's an acceptable level of overlap. But we agree, without the court having any regulation of this industry, what's really at stake here is whether or not Morgan Drexen is going to be free from regulation on both ends. They're not subject to this court's regulation, and they're, without the statute being applied, not subject to the General Assembly's regulation either. They're trying to fall in that middle where they're free of any regulation. But, as you have noted, Your Honor, there is no rule directly on point here, making this a more direct case than Crow versus Toll, in which there was a rule on point, but the rules were interpreted harmoniously and it was an acceptable level of overlap. We don't believe you need to even get to that analysis, because you can simply find that the separation of powers doctrine doesn't apply to non-attorneys. But if it did, if there was some overlap, it wouldn't automatically mean the rule were conflicted. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You certainly may do so. Mr. Dunn?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Before I begin, I thought it would help the Court to just give you a roadmap about how Mr. Gurr and I plan to divide our time. I plan to address issues around the original DMSA, as well as the exclusion from the legal services exemption of the amended DMSA for non-employees of attorneys. And Mr. Gurr, I will try to leave 10 minutes for him to address the out-of-state attorney carve-out from the amended DMSA. Both as a matter of statutory construction and constitutional law, an attorney's paraprofessional support staff is covered by the the legal services exception of the original DMSA. And the district court properly found that as a matter of statutory construction, Morgan Drexen qualifies for that exception. Likewise, the exclusion of an attorney's non-employee paraprofessionals from the legal services exception to the amended DMSA violates the separation of powers doctrine of the Colorado Constitution, because it improperly interferes with this court's exclusive jurisdiction to regulate attorneys in the practice of law. Starting with the original DMSA, the administrator makes two statutory interpretation arguments. In the first one, although it's only touched on briefly in the briefs, I think it's significant and it's quite incredible. The administrator argues that the term legal services does not include debt management, and therefore attorneys engaging in debt management cannot claim the legal services exception and must register. If that's true, then the Debt Management Act directly conflicts with the rules of professional conduct in this court's jurisdiction. Moreover, it creates an absurd result. If lawyers engaging in debt management cannot claim the legal services, the legal services exception, then the exception itself becomes a nullity. Or if lawyers engaging in debt management can't claim the exception, then no one can. And of course, the legislature would not intend to write legislation that had no effect.
Let me just jump in right here, if I may. I'm sorry to do this to you so quickly, but while you're on this subject of what constitutes legal service, the trial court found that there was supervision. Where's the supervision here? $2 a contract, it seems like a rubber stamp. Help me understand how it's not.
I would answer that two ways, Your Honor. First, the contracts that were provided by the administrator was an out-of-state contract attached to their brief below on their 56H motion. That there was no evidence that that was used in Colorado, and it was not relied on by the trial court. What you're referring to is simply in the administrative brief. What was relied on by the court was the affidavits of Mr. Williamson, Mr. Letta, and the contract between Mr. Moore and his clients. And I forget the first part of your question, I'm sorry.
Well, ultimately my question is just about whether there really is supervision that's going on.
So the district court in its order said, as it went through the three-part test of the legal services exception, there has to be legal services, there has to be an attorney-client relationship, and it has to be provided by an attorney licensed or otherwise authorized to practice in Colorado. The court marched through those three parts of the test and found that all three were met based on the undisputed evidence in the case. Now, there is a reference in the district court to supervision. What's important is that the attorney-client contract, in this case between Mr. Moore and Colorado residents, as well as the contract between Morgan Drexen and either Mr. Williamson or Mr. Moore, or in general between the attorney, established the supervision. Under the rules of professional conduct and their contracts, the attorney supervised Morgan Drexen in communicating with creditors. Beyond that, it's a question for the Attorney Regulation Council. So returning to the statutory construction, the administrator also takes the exceedingly narrow position that the exception should be read as applicable only to attorneys and not to their staff. First, the obvious intent of the legislative or legal services exception was to avoid the constitutional conflict between this court's authority and that of the executive and legislative branches. The carve-outs for lawyers from regulatory statutes in Colorado are numerous, and they're all based on separation of powers. They're not policy decisions of the legislature because of some favoritism to lawyers, but they're based on the legislature recognizing its limited power. And to my knowledge, the state has not enforced any of those regulatory schemes against a lawyer's assistant.
A direct employee. An employee.
Or a non-employee. Based on conduct
well,
serving the lawyer.
The language here of the revised acts as employee, right? If not an employee, they're subject to the regulation of the act.
That's correct. What's interesting about that, Justice Hobbs, is that the administrator contends that the point of that amendment was not simply to carve out non-employees from being able to claim the exemption. Their argument is that it was just a clarification of what already was in law in the original DMSA, under their argument that it excluded both non-employee and employee non-attorneys, and that amendment was...
In other words, just a clarifying amendment.
Yeah, but that's right. But what's odd about it is it was apparently only intended to clarify one portion. Mm-hmm. If really the intent was to clarify that non-lawyers cannot claim the exemption, the administrator would have suggested that to the legislature, and that's what the legislature would have
But it's our job to construe the language, right?
Right.
And the legislature's intent. So why are we arguing the prior version of the statute here?
Because that's the version that Morgan Drexen operated under and the version of the act that the administrator sought to enforce against them.
So they would have to come back under the new act, new revision or something? Is this just a problem of retroactive, retrospective, you know, whatever we have to sort out?
With regard to their conduct prior to 2011, yes.
Right.
But Morgan Drexen, if it's hired by attorneys that have clients in Colorado, would of course love to go forward in Colorado and do business with attorneys that have clients here. So both the amended DMSA and the original are applicable.
Would you remind us, though, how this came up procedurally and why both of these statutes were at issue in the ruling?
Sure. So prior to the amendments in 2011, the administrator had sought to, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, but had sought to cease the activity of companies like Morgan Drexen. There were a variety of discussions back and forth. Morgan Drexen chose to bring a declaratory judgment action against the administrator for clarification on what the original DMSA meant as far as the legal services exception. It was during that period of time that the administrator, by their own admission in their briefs, ran across the street and sought to amend the law specifically to target Morgan Drexen and companies like it, as well as attorneys like Mr. Williamson, to carve them out from the legal services exception.
Totally admirable, correct? Let's get the law clarified here so we don't have a separation of powers problem. What's wrong with that?
Separation.
If they ran across the street and got some kind of a, you know, thing to target your client, I don't get that at all. They're trying to clarify a statute that protects Colorado consumers.
The separation of powers doctrine either allows the regulation of non-attorneys or it doesn't. And the fact that the administrator tried to specifically carve out language so that it would apply to Morgan Drexen doesn't change that analysis. So I think the administrator found herself in a little bit of a box. They found that they didn't like what Morgan Drexen was doing for the attorneys it was working for. So they looked at the statute and they said, well, geez, it says attorneys are excluded. Well, we'll tell them that we think non-attorneys are not excluded. Then the action was brought. So they said, well, then we can't argue that that non-attorneys can't claim the exception. We'll just say that non-employee non-attorneys can't claim the exception, and we'll try and carve out-of-state attorneys because we probably can't carve out in-state attorneys under the separation of powers.
Whether they ran or walked, though, the point is that both of these were the subject of declaratory relief. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Francisco talked about the rules of professional conduct and Rule 5.3, Comment 1. Now, he made the statement that the rules don't apply to paraprofessionals. Well, that's true. That begs the question, or makes our point. It's the attorneys that are subject to the rules of professional conduct, and it's the attorneys that are responsible for the conduct of their paraprofessionals. Under Rule 5.3, Comment 1, it says a lawyer should give such assistants appropriate instruction and supervision concerning the ethical aspects of their employment, particularly regarding the obligations not to disclose information relating to representation of the client, and should be responsible for their work product. Such assistants, whether employees or independent contractors, particularly relevant here, act for the lawyers in rendition of the lawyer's professional services. That was what the district court relied on to make the connection. That's what this court has always relied on, whether it's in cases of this court, whether it's in the ethics opinions. There has always been well established that attorneys and their non-attorney support staff are one. It's an artificial distinction to say that they're not. And let me give you an example why in this case that's true. Take the hypothetical of a solo practitioner who has a single paralegal. And the issue is whether or not the DMSA applies to the paralegal. Let's say for a moment it does. Now you have a situation where an attorney is operating under one set of rules, the rules of professional conduct, and his paralegal is operating under the Debt Management Act. So how do you draft an attorney-client contract? Do you follow the rules of professional conduct, or do you follow the Debt Management Act, which has very specific provisions, down to the color and borders that must be around warnings in client contracts? How about fees? The rules of professional conduct require that attorneys charge reasonable fees. The Debt Management Act, of course, has specific requirements around fees. The list goes on and on of how it would create such a
problem. I don't understand why this problem you raise isn't just solved by the fact that our regulations go to licensed attorneys, period. That's who's covered, that's who's regulated. Their conduct is regulated. The rest of these people, including the paralegals, are not licensed attorneys.
I'll give you another example of a conflict to maybe address that. So when a licensed provider is communicating with a client under the Act, there's very specific limitations on what they can say and what they can advise them to do under the Debt Management Act. Under the rules of professional conduct, that obviously is not true. The lawyer has a professional responsibility to communicate with a prospective client or an existing client in a way that they feel in their best judgment advises that client. The Debt Management Act prohibits that. It has very specific limitations on what can be said to the consumer. I think there's a variety of other provisions like that where the lawyer and their paraprofessional would be at odds about what they could say. And here's the other interesting thing.
For clarification purposes, though, in your hypothetical, that paralegal, if a paralegal were an employee of the attorney, we wouldn't have this concern. I mean, they would be covered as an employee.
Not under the original DMSA.
And so,
under the state's argument.
Not under the original DMSA. I thought the argument was that the 2011 amendment was a clarification.
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I think they've taken various positions about that. I don't think what Mr. Francisco said in terms of what the amended DMSA does in terms of non-employees is consistent with what's in their briefing, where it says it was just a clarification of what was already in law.
Okay.
But let me continue, and just so I think this goes to a little bit of your question, back to the hypothetical and the question about supervision. To make the point that that is truly a role for the Attorney Regulation Council and not the administrator or even the district court, if you allow a district court or the administrator to say to an attorney, you're not supervising your paralegal or your outside support staff, then that would trigger registration and violations on behalf of or by the support staff. You have a situation where a paralegal or an outside company is all of a sudden subject to the DMSA and is liable for violations of that based on the conduct of the attorney. And we can't have a situation where the support staff has to supervise the attorney supervising of the support staff. It's just a nonsensical, untenable situation.
Well, what we have to have is the attorney educated about what the paralegal or the outside employees can do.
That's right. That's what the rules of professional conduct are for.
Well, fine.
But the
sanction there is suspension or, you know, disbarment or whatever.
That's exactly right. But what happens in that case? Does that make then the outside support staff like Morgan Drexen then all of a sudden subject to the DMSA?
They should be given the advice, maybe, if they're going to take this on. Maybe they ought to be making the communication, not the paralegals.
They can certainly do that, but the point is that they won't know when that's triggered. If an attorney who engages, and let's just take an in-house paralegal, if an attorney fails to do their job in supervising that paraprofessional, it can't be that that all of a sudden triggers liability for the paraprofessional.
I'm not saying that's what happens. That under the Consumer Debt Act, I mean, you know, maybe the attorney has to very carefully either make the contacts or tell the employees and the outside professionals what their communication can be.
Under the rules of professional conduct.
And the attorney would be held for that, not the paralegals. The paralegals, assuming they're under the direction of the attorneys. But I'm just not seeing how separation of powers, and sometimes we have overlapping jurisdiction, is served by your argument here. Somehow they're not regulated. Either way, either under the attorney regulation scheme or under the Debt Management Act, and I think that's the thrust of your argument. So would you help me through that?
Sure. So a provider of debt management who's assisting an attorney is either subject to the Act or they're not. And it's the administrator's position that but for the attorney exemption, they would be, and they would have to register, and they would have to follow the provisions, and they would be liable for their conduct under the Act. That's the support staff. And the only reason they're not subject to all that is because they're claiming through the attorney the exemption. If the exemption goes away for the attorney, it goes away for the support staff. And then the support staff is then subject to the requirements of the act. Now, it may be that the attorney is grieved and has issues there, but it doesn't change that, according to the administrator, the support staff is now subject to the act because they can't claim the exemption any longer.
Well, what I'm concerned about is it seems like the attorneys are working for these debt management agencies, not vice versa.
So long, I mean,
they're just added on here to claim some kind of immunity or protection. At least that's what I'm feeling from your argument.
Justice Hobbs, I would say this. There's no question that the practice of debt management is very different than the practice of law that we're all used to, and that most of you, I think, when you were in private practice, participated in. It's a high-volume business with low margins. It's much like personal injury law or debt collection. And you have solo practitioners who rely heavily on their support staff, much as a personal injury firm does, where their paraprofessionals do 90% of the work, 95% of the work. And I don't know where that line is of when it becomes a question of supervision, but that's a role for the Attorney Regulation Council, not the administrator and not the district court. And so long as the three-part test of the act is met, that it's a legal service, which there's no question debt negotiations is, that it's in the attorney-client context. No question here that it was, because Mr. Moore had an attorney-client contract and Morgan Drexen had a contract with its attorneys. And lastly, this provided by licensed attorneys in Colorado. Undisputed here that was met as well. Once those three elements are met, whether that line is crossed where the attorney is no longer doing their job of supervision, that's an issue for attorney regulation. In fact, that's how it played out here. In this case, a complaint was made, and I've been authorized to say this, a complaint was made against Mr. Moore by one of his clients to the administrator or to the Attorney General's office. That was forwarded on to Attorney Regulation Council, and they looked into it. That's the proper mechanism for resolving the issues around whether the attorney is doing their job. But whether or not the support staff has to register under the act and be subject to its requirements and liabilities can't be determined by the degree to which the attorney is engaging in their supervision.
Can I ask a question here? Can an attorney have support staff for purposes of doing something other than the practice of law?
You mean within the context of the act or just in general?
Well, I'm thinking in general because, and let me, where I'm going with this is, it seems to me the thrust of your position is that by creating an exception for attorneys, the legislature has in effect recognized whatever we call this, debt management, as the practice of law. And that being the case, you can't stop the attorney from having his support staff helping with that. But is that necessarily the case? And I'm thinking just loosely, sometimes we'll see situations where attorneys will be involved in both real estate and the practice of law. But they clearly could have support staff doing matters for real estate which are not assisting them with the practice of law.
The question is, and this is the Crow analysis, right? Is when does the support staff support the legal practice of the attorney? So if it was a copy company, certainly attorneys, law firms use copy companies. There's no question that if there were a copy company regulation, that would probably be valid and not implicate the separation of powers. Okay. But you know where that line is, I don't know, between a copy company and what's going on with the DMSA. But it's very distinct from what the CCPA case, right, in Crow, that Mr. Francisco relied on. That was very different. First of all, I think, Justice Hood, you raised this question. The CCPA, and I want to leave time for Mr. Gurr here, the CCPA is clearly a remedial provision. The DMSA may be in part remedial, but it's primarily regulatory. It has remedial components, but it's regulatory. It's intended to regulate conduct of certain individuals, and it regulates them down to the finest detail of their conduct. Because as Mr. Francisco said, there's a lot of consumers involved, and that was an important policy decision of the legislature. So it's very different. Crow specifically said that where legislative enactments can operate in parallel and consistent with the rules of professional conduct, they can do so. So the examples of in criminal law, of course, if a lawyer is found to have violated the criminal code, they violated the rules of professional conduct. If you violate the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, you violated the rules of professional conduct. Those are in parallel and consistent with the rules of professional conduct. As I articulated previously, the Debt Management Act violates or conflicts with the rules of professional conduct in numerous ways. No further questions. I'll turn it over to Mr. Kerr. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Lawrence Williamson and Drew Moore. Mr. Williamson is a Kansas attorney. He practices law in Colorado pursuant to Rule 220. As a matter of note, not only is he an out-of-state attorney authorized to practice law under Rule 220, if you look at Rule 220D, it states that an attorney who is authorized to practice law pursuant to Rule 220 is deemed to be licensed under Colorado law. Now, to your question, Justice Hobbs, has the state legislature violated or not respected this court's exclusive jurisdiction with respect to the admission and regulation of lawyers? Mr. Williamson has been informed by the state, the administrator, that he has to register with the administrator prior to practicing debt management law in the state of Colorado. Mr. Williamson must apply. Mr. Williamson must give them fees, application fees. He's subject to being allowed or disallowed, having his license from this court to practice law revoked by the administrator if he doesn't pass their process. The fees he can charge his clients are subject to regulation of the Debt Management Services Act. The advice he can give his clients are subject to regulation of the Debt Management Services Act. His records are subject to disclosure upon request. Indeed, the genesis of this case, to your question, Justice Coates, is in August of 2011, before we filed this suit. Drew Moore and other local Colorado counsel for Mr. Williamson were subpoenaed by the administrator, and all of their records related to their debt management services were subpoenaed. We objected, and it was that objection, which is in the record, you can see the correspondence we had with the administrator's counsel, led to this declaratory judgment. It's putting squarely at issue. And to your point, just aside as to Mr. Williamson standing here, he is affected by this statute. Anyone affected by a statute has standing to challenge that statute. It implicates his rights to practice law under this court's license. It's capable of being resolved by the court. It's a justiciable controversy. The district court will resolve this dispute. So with respect to standing, which for the first time was raised in a reply brief, and I understand the issue of standing is de novo review, but the question of standing, by the way, was admitted in their answer below. But just Mr. Williamson is impacted directly. He was faced with the choice of complying or not complying.
Well, doesn't this exemption here in the revised statute take care of this situation?
No, it doesn't.
Why not?
Not as applied. Mr. Williamson is challenging the constitutionality both on its face and as it is applied. The way they are applying it, and if you look at what they're arguing here, they're arguing Mr. Williamson, as an out-of-state attorney, must register. Because the original act, the exclusion in the original act said it doesn't apply to attorneys licensed in the state of Colorado or otherwise authorized to do so. In the amendment, they deleted the second part. And now it only says attorneys licensed in the state of Colorado. And the administrator is treating that as a numbered license. a lawyer like me who has a bar number. Now, they're saying because Mr. Williamson is an out-of-state attorney who is only authorized to practice law under Rule 220 and he doesn't hold a numbered license, he must register. And that's the separation of powers at issue here. The argument...
Counsel, if I might interrupt right here, you've referred a couple of times to Rule 220D.
Yeah.
And
I mean 4.
I'm sorry?
224, I may have...
224D. And we've revamped all of our rules of professional conduct and these bar admission rules, and I'm wondering if you could direct us to where that provision may have been updated or what it looks like today.
Okay. I'm referring, forgive me, to what I know is Rule 224. And it provides an out-of-state attorney who engages in the practice of law in Colorado pursuant to Rule 220 shall be deemed for the purposes of Colorado Revised Statutes, Title 12, Article 5, to have obtained a license for the limited scope of practice specified in this rule. And I apologize for not knowing the current cite to that provision. The question, Justice Hood, is there supervision here? Whether there's supervision here. First of all, that question I don't think was central to the district court's holding, but the fact is, yes. This court, at the referral of the Attorney General, after the holding came down, investigated, transitory committee investigated Mr. Moore, investigated supervision, they investigated the agreements, they investigated the fees. I produced all that stuff. Mr. Moore entered into a diversion agreement. And that is working the way it should work. This court has jurisdiction over attorneys and whether or not their attorneys are adequately supervising their non-lawyer assistants, whether they're employees or they're non-employees, he still has a duty to do so. Now, there's nothing that needs regulated that's not being regulated here. Certainly, Mr. Williamson doesn't need to be regulated. He's already subject to this court's regulation under Rule 251.1, which provides that this court has jurisdiction over attorneys authorized to practice law under 220, as both to their discipline and their capacity.
Well, you've got a huge burden here, though. Get approved, yeah. This is unconstitutional, this act, the revised yeah. act, the former act, beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
No, I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Why?
With respect to, this is a, Mr. Williamson's right to practice law is a fundamental right, and for purposes of the Privileges and Immunities Act, several states' Supreme Courts have held that the right to practice law is a fundamental right, not subject to reasonable doubt standard, but it requires the state to demonstrate the purpose behind the act. I would refer the court to a couple things. First,
well, let me just, if I may, just
sure.
quickly before you run out of time, can you just tell me what your response is to the assertion that it's facially neutral, therefore you don't really have a claim under privileges and immunities?
Well, I'd refer the court to what was Rule 220, which says out-of-state attorneys. Obviously, if it regulates out-of-state attorneys differently than in-state attorneys. Real quickly, on the question of the fundamental right to practice law and privileges and immunities, I would refer the court to a Massachusetts case, matter of JADD, J-A-D-D, 461 Northeast 2nd, 760, and a very recent Second Circuit Court of Appeals case addressing this very issue, 748 F3rd 464, where the Second Circuit referred, certified the question to the New York Court of Appeals as to whether or not disparate treatment of out-of-state attorneys is a fundamental right subject to under the Privileges and Immunities Act.
Any further questions, anyone?
No. No, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you,
Mr. Francisco, you have some time remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, a quick housekeeping matter. I believe the rule number has been changed to 205. What we've been referring to as Rule 220 in the briefs and in the argument, I think, is Rule 205. I think it's helpful to consider, under the separation of powers, how little the DMSA interferes with licensed attorneys' practice of law. Consider what they can still do under our statute without any separation of powers problem. They can still practice debt management services. They can still service clients who have debts. They can still hire support staff. In fact, they can still hire support staff to do everything Warden Drexen represents that they need to do to help attorneys. They can still hire, even on an independent contractor basis, somebody to do almost everything Warden Drexen represents that they do. The Debt Management Services Act only applies and is triggered when a provider qualifies under the statute because they serve as an intermediary communicating to creditors on behalf of a debtor. So everything you hear in the brief about the need for efficiency, document processing, computer software, all of that can still be done on an employee or a contract basis. That's not what is issued in this case. Under the separation of powers argument, the argument this afternoon has become one of interference, that any general statute regulation that interferes with an attorney hiring that contractor violates the separation of powers. That's certainly not this court's holding in Crow, and indeed, even when you consider what's been said about the Crow case from Mr. Dunn, he's represented that the case says that parallel or consistent statutes can survive. Even under that reading of the case, the DMSA should easily survive because it is certainly, at most, parallel to this court's regulation of attorneys. Briefly, as to the out-of-state attorneys issue.
Counsel, before you go on to that, can I just get you to address your opposing counsel's argument that really it's impractical, I guess, because you've got two regulatory regimes, one applying to the attorney and one applying to the paralegal, and those are either inconsistent or it just is really interfering with the practice of law?
Yes, Your Honor. I have multiple responses. The first is that there's not dual regulation. Attorney regulation in this court is not regulating debt services providers. So there's not even that basis. Secondly, the dual regulation argument, as I said earlier, was clearly rejected in the Crow case. And additionally, I think what has been said applies far beyond just debt services providers and proves that this argument proves too much. Consider private investigators. It may interfere with an attorney who wants to hire a particular private investigator because that private investigator is not licensed. That is a new statute that was adopted last year. And so as to that attorney, they would make the same argument that they are making here today, which is it interferes with my ability to hire the one private investigator I want because he's not licensed. That doesn't create the kind of manifest conflict with this court's regulation of attorneys that triggers separation of powers concerns.
So I guess your answer to that is we just have to live with that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
We just have to live with that conflict, or the lawyers have to live with that conflict.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This is not unique to debt services providers. Private investigators are licensed. There's a whole host of regulations and rules about notaries. Very many of the service providers that attorneys hire are subject to general laws. And you could always say that those general laws are restricting or imposing some limitations, some level of interference. That is certainly true. It's just not enough to create a separation of powers concern. And indeed, the word interference is telling. Interference is not the standard for a separation of powers violation. It has to be a manifest inconsistency, a substantial conflict. And they have not shown that there is that level of conflict between an attorney's ability to practice law and the regulations imposed on debt services providers. Briefly, I'd like to talk about the out-of-state attorneys issue. First, as to the standard review, Justice Hobbs, our brief clearly explains that a fundamental right under the Privileges and Immunities Clause is not the same as a fundamental right under the 14th Amendment. And so this court's beyond reasonable doubt standard clearly applies. I don't think there's any dispute in the cases about that. Additionally, the news about Mr. Moore being in a diversion agreement is first of all beside the point. We're not seeking to regulate licensed attorneys. That's not the position in the case. And second of all, it's completely new information that wasn't raised in the briefs.
What about the status under our rule? It's not a licensed, they're authorized to practice here. Would you just explore that a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. The statute has been amended to be consistent with numerous other statutes we pointed before in the brief, where certain exemptions are given to licensed attorneys, but they're not extended to attorneys who are merely authorized to practice under what's now Rule 205. We contend that that doesn't create the sort of manifest conflict. But if it did create a conflict, it would be a concern far beyond the statute. We identified four statutes in the briefs that operate that way. We've since found at least six other statutes where the General Assembly has extended an exemption from some particular law only to licensed attorneys.
I'm sorry, could you respond to the comment from your opposing counsel that under the rule, even under current 205.1 sub 2, which deals with the scope of authority, it's the 220D that's now been apparently relocated, but it says an out-of-state attorney who engages in the practice of law in Colorado pursuant to this rule shall be deemed to have obtained a license for the limited scope of practice specified in the rule. And so at least under the rules, for our disciplinary purposes, these attorneys are considered to have to be licensed for these limited scope of practice certifications that we have in Rule 205. So how do we sort of look at that in connection with the wording of the statute?
We understand, Your Honor, that an otherwise authorized under this rule is indeed technically a limited license. They can't hear an appearance in court. They have to abide by all of those restrictions. As a matter of statutory interpretation, we believe the district court was correct below, and all the parties, frankly, were in agreement that the wording used by the legislature should be understood that licensed refers to the traditional sense, and the wording otherwise authorized refers to what is technically a limited license.
And I guess where I'm scratching my head a little bit is that if we're the ones who are deciding who gets to be licensed and we're treating these folks as if they had a license, is there really a distinction?
We believe there is a distinction for applying the statutes.
Well, I would suggest to you that if we license them, which it sounds like we have, the plain language of this act, especially the exemption, would say they're licensed. I mean, I'm sorry, we have to construe the language of the statute. If they're licensed by us, they're within the exemption of the statute. What do you say to that?
I don't believe that's consistent with the legislative intent and the plain language of distinguishing in this particular statute between licensed to practice in the state or otherwise authorized.
But that's gone.
That or otherwise authorized was deleted. That's exactly
correct. Let's assume this is a clarifying language. But in any event, it may get into our bailiwick if you are trying to subject these licensed attorneys to this act. They're licensed according to what our colleague here just read.
Well, that raises a factual clarification. The administrator is not seeking to actively go out there and look for out-of-state attorneys to impose the law against. The attorneys were brought in this action to try to bring color to Warden Drexen's arguments. At most, Your Honor, this court would interpret the statute that way, which we disagree with, and I think arguments in the briefs made clear. It would only provide some sort of relief to that out-of-state attorney who was otherwise authorized. What it would not do is do anything for Morgan Drexen, which there's no dispute. Under the amended version of the statute, Morgan Drexen is a provider of debt management services in Colorado. The amendment was clearly drafted to cover Morgan Drexen's activities because they're not an employee of a law firm. So that issue would not go to the heart of the case, which is whether or not the act can regulate non-attorneys who associate with attorneys. The old version of the statute, I wanted to clarify how that's particularly relevant. In our view, the prior version of the statute, the question of whether or not it applies to Morgan Drexen, is relevant to possible restitution that Morgan Drexen may owe if the statute is upheld. The amended version of the statute is the one that controls, that is prospective. That's the one, Justice Coates, that people briefed below on 56H. Both versions are relevant because of the time frame that Morgan Drexen's activities cover, but on a going forward basis, the legal question that will control is whether the amended version of the statute violates the separation of powers or not. And it's important to note that Morgan Drexen previously disputed that they were a provider of debt management services, but they have not appealed that issue. They've now conceded that they are indeed a provider of debt management services. Their only avenue for avoiding this regulation is for the separation of powers doctrine to apply to non-attorneys. As to the reading of the Crow case, it's not material whether or not this court would view it as a remedial or a regulatory statute. We believe it is remedial. I think those cases are reflected in the briefs. But more importantly, the things that this court looked at in the Crow case when applied here would say that there's not the type of conflict from regulating debt management services providers that raised an Article III concern. The separation of powers certainly does apply when we're talking about the regulation directly of attorneys. And in this case, with the amendment on this issue, we're dealing with expressly the regulation of non-attorneys, not of attorneys. The wording in the case talks about some overlap between judicial rulemaking and legislative policy is permissible. That's important to note here that, unlike that case where there was judicial rulemaking about attorney advertising, there just is no rule covering the debt management services. So the analysis should be simpler than it was in that case, and there shouldn't be a separation of powers concern. My colleague argued here that attorneys and their assistants should be construed as one. And with respect, that is not what the attorney regulation rules say. Attorneys obviously are responsible for their assistants and their paralegals, but paralegals can't enter an appearance in court. They can't practice law. Attorneys and assistants are not to be construed as one. That is what's necessary. That type of a conclusion is what would be necessary in order to apply the separation of powers here. But this court is never so held and would be contrary to the entire scope of attorney regulation to say that attorneys and everybody they hire must be construed as one for all purposes. Taken at a broader level, this statute is not unique. It is the General Assembly exercising a police power, in this case, to try to protect Colorado consumers in a particularly predatory industry. The attempt to use attorneys to become exempt from that is what has been done in this case and what should not be allowed under the separation of powers. Finally, Mr. Dunn said that the debt management practice is unlike the traditional practice of law and that it is a high volume area just like personal injury practice. That leads this court directly back to the Crow decision, in which the court noted that the personal injury practice at issue in Crow was a high volume practice. And indeed, the regulations apply there as here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted. I want to thank the